From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Last night, Stephanie Clifford, the porn star who goes by the name Stormy Daniels, went public on 60 Minutes, telling Anderson Cooper about an alleged affair with Donald Trump.
The president watches 60 Minutes. If he's watching tonight, what would you say to him?
He knows I'm telling the truth.
The adult film star signed a $130,000 deal with President Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, not to talk about the affair, and she claimed she was threatened to keep quiet. This hour, On Point, Stormy Daniels' interview and her battle with President Trump. You can join us on air or online. Did you watch the 60 Minutes interview? Did you avoid it? Can you believe it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we're going to talk about the outpouring of protesters across the U.S. who called for an end to gun violence this weekend. But first, joining me now from New York is David Folkenflik. He's media correspondent for NPR. David, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Anthony.
Also joining us from New York is Meredith Blake, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. She wrote a piece headlined "How Stormy Daniels' Candor and Humor in Her 60 Minutes Interview Showed a Woman to be Reckoned With." You can link to her piece at our website, On Point Radio. Meredith, good to have you. Thanks for joining us at On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you.
Yep.
Before we start, let's hear some tape from last night. The very first question Anderson Cooper asked Stormy Daniels during last night's 60 Minutes interview was about the risk involved and whether or not she could be fined $1 million for even talking to him. Here's what she said.
I guess I'm not 100% sure on why you're doing this.
Because it was very important to me to be able to defend myself.
Is part of talking wanting to set the record straight?
100%.
Why does the record need to be set straight?
Because people are just saying whatever they wanted to say about me. I was perfectly fine saying nothing at all. But I'm not okay with being made out to be a liar or people thinking that I did this for money. And people are like, oh, you're an opportunist. You're taking advantage of this.
Stormy Daniels talking last night on 60 Minutes with Anderson Cooper. David, I'll start with you. Tell us what we learned from this interview. What stood out to you?
I guess there were a couple of things. I mean, I think viewers were given the opportunity to try to assess Stormy Daniels, as we'll call her, on her own, you know, presentation. They got to be able to figure out, you know, the degree to which they wanted to give her credibility, both through the answers she provided to the correspondent on this, Anderson Cooper, but also through her demeanor and how she carried herself. I think that one of the big things that we learned was that she claimed after 2011 and that she had given an interview to In Touch magazine, that a man came up to her while she was carrying her infant and essentially said, this is almost literally what she said, that, boy, you have a beautiful looking baby there. It'd be a shame if something were to happen to her. And that he threatened her and said, you know, don't talk about Trump. Leave Trump alone, I believe were exact words.
Yeah, David, and let's listen to that moment. I want to come back to you, but let's listen to that moment because we have it queued up right now. Here it is.
I was in a parking lot going to a fitness class with my infant daughter. I was taking, you know, the seats facing backwards in the back seat, diaper bag, you know, getting all the stuff out. And a guy walked up on me and said to me, leave Trump alone, forget the story. And then he leaned around and looked at my daughter and said, it's a beautiful little girl. It'd be a shame if something happened to her mom. And then he was gone.
So, David, I think that stands out as one of the more dramatic moments in last night's interview, don't you think?
Absolutely. You know, it is connecting in some ways in perhaps the most visceral way possible the threat that she says and the use of essentially authority and power that she's saying has been used by the president's lawyer, Michael Cohen, against her in legal and financial threats and saying it also was a personal threat and that it preceded that there's essentially a pattern of threatening her that precedes even the legal interventions that occurred just before the elections in the fall of 2016. And, you know, that's as menacing and as thuggish an allegation as you can imagine. It sounds almost mafia style.
Yeah, it really does. Meredith, your piece this morning in the LA Times, how Stormy Daniels' candor and humor in her 60 Minutes interview showed a woman to be reckoned with. In what way?
I think it showed that she's someone who's blunt and matter of fact, and I think was very candid about her motives in terms of her dealings with Trump. And she obviously had, she's very self-aware of her own image as a porn star, adult film actress, however you want to characterize her line of work. And I think that in a way, her honesty about her motives made her more credible in some ways. You know, she made it clear that Anderson Cooper asked her about, you know, charges of opportunism, and she said basically, well, who wouldn't want to get paid more for what they're already doing? And I think there's a kind of honesty to that that I found compelling, and that perhaps others will too.
I want to talk about what might cast doubt on her credibility. For example, at several points, she has denied having the affair with Trump. Last night, she said that she'd been told that if she didn't agree to the denials, quote, they can make your life hell in many different ways. So let's listen to a little bit of this conversation with Anderson Cooper last night when she addressed her continued denial of her affair with Donald Trump, even as recently as January 2018.
So you signed and released a statement that said, I'm not denying this affair because I was paid in hush money. I'm denying it because it never happened. That's a lie.
Yes.
If it was untruthful, why did you sign it?
Because they made it sound like I had no choice.
I mean, no one was putting a gun to your head.
Not physical violence, no.
You thought that there would be some sort of legal repercussion if you didn't sign
Correct.
It.
Correct. As a matter of fact, the exact sentence used was, they can make your life hell in many different ways.
They being?
I'm not exactly sure who they were. I believe it to be Michael Cohen.
Michael Cohen, that would be Donald Trump's lawyers. Listeners, we're talking about Stormy Daniels' interview last night with Anderson Cooper on 60 Minutes. Did you watch it? What did you make of it? Did you believe her? But Meredith Blake, come back to this question about her credibility. We just heard her addressing that directly with Anderson Cooper. What did you hear there?
Well, she said that she signed the deal because she was scared for her family. And she'd, you know, if you believe her claim about this 2011 encounter with this man in the parking lot, it's understandable that she would have signed the hush agreement and that she later on would have you know, a few months later in January, she, you know, also denied the alleged affair. I think that if you, you know, if this all really happened, then it's perfectly understandable that she'd want it to go away, given the renewed scrutiny and interest in this story that had kind of been buried for 5 years.
Let's go to Patty, who's calling from Northampton, Massachusetts. Patty, what you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, Anthony.
Hi there.
Hi there. I'm calling just to remind people that there's nothing that is being revealed about Donald Trump's behavior and his infidelities that's going to turn people off to Donald Trump who really like Donald Trump. He's done everything he could to turn off the voters and the electorate in the United States, and they just, you know, there's a base there that just really loves his actions. And it's curious as to why that is. He's totally destroyed the commander-in-chief position of the United States and the integrity of it. And he's very much not the kind of leader that inspires optimism. And I don't know what is really so important about Stormy Daniels. I don't see it.
Patty, I got your point, and we're going to put it to, I want to put it both to David Folkenflik and Meredith Blake. David, I'll start with you. I mean, there is sort of a straight line from the Access Hollywood tape in which Trump acknowledged sexually assaulting women. In the end, his supporters didn't care about that. They voted for him. Now there are allegations of an affair, a payment of hush money, maybe a threat. Do you think this changes anyone's thinking about Donald Trump?
Well, certainly it fits in with, you know, presidential advisor Kellyanne Conway used to say, you know, the voters decided in November 2016, and so that's not an issue we have to address anymore. The public knows that. Let's just move past. These were allegations that do, just as you say, fit into, you know, what we know of who Donald Trump was before he became president. You know, he either was or played a character who was leering, sort of treated women as sexual objects in many ways, was a tabloid figure. And now that tabloid figure not only has entered the presidency, but is turning the presidency into a tabloid story, which is really, in normal circumstances, what you would think the Stormy Daniels story and scandal to be. You know, this isn't a really a scandal about sex. In this case, what Stormy Daniels is raising is the specter of the use of power and in some ways intimidation by people acting on behalf of one of the two leading candidates in the couple of days before the elections to act to thwart her from speaking what she says is the truth and doing so in very intense ways. You know, these were allegations that were initially denied, and yet, you know, the Wall Street Journal's reporting ultimately unearthed a six-figure settlement done through a Delaware shell company that appears to have been set up precisely for this transaction by the lawyer to the president of the United States. And I think the scandal is not about whether or not the president of the United States, you know, more than a decade before being elected into office, had a sexual liaison with a woman who stars in pornographic films, but rather a question of the length to which he tried to suppress that story and what it entailed. You know, obviously Cooper and others, and we can talk about that in some minutes, raise questions about whether or not this violated certain kinds of campaign finance laws and contributions. But I think the question – Stormy Daniels said this is not a Me Too moment, that she's not a victim, that her sex was consensual, but that she went into it because she realized she had gotten herself into a bad situation. But this really is a question about, at least in her allegations, an inversion of power, and that she felt somewhat intimidated by the role he played and his people played in his behalf.
David Folkenflik, stand by, and Meredith Blake, stand by. We're going to continue this conversation. David, you mentioned Michael Cohen, Trump's lawyer, and we're going to talk a lot about his role when we return after the break. One fact here, the interview last night on 60 Minutes, highest ratings for 60 Minutes in 10 years. It beat the interview with President-elect Barack Obama and his wife, Michelle Obama. Best ratings in 10 years. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Mindy Thomas.
And together, we bring you Wow in the World,
NPR's podcast for families.
Every week, we explore wild and new scientific discoveries.
We also ride a bird. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're talking about adult film star Stormy Daniels' 60 Minutes interview in which she offered details about her alleged affair with Donald Trump. You can join the conversation. Does Michael Cohen, Trump's attorney, does his legal vulnerability give special counsel Bob Mueller a way into the White House in his investigation into Russian collusion in last year's election? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR, and Meredith Blake, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. Let's listen to one more cut from last night's interview, the 60 Minutes interview with Stormy Daniels. Here's attorney Michael Avenatti, Stormy Daniels' attorney, explaining why this case matters.
This is about the cover-up. This is about the extent that Mr. Cohen and the president have gone to intimidate this woman, to silence her, to threaten her, and to put her under their thumb. It is thuggish behavior from people in power, and it has no place in American democracy.
Let me introduce another guest into our conversation. Joining us now from Washington is Stephen Spaulding. He's chief of strategy and external affairs at Common Cause, a nonpartisan watchdog group. He formerly served as the special counsel to Commissioner Anne Revelle of the Federal Election Commission. And Stephen Spaulding, it's good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
I want to ask you about Michael Cohen, Trump's lawyer. Trump has denied the affair, yet Cohen acknowledged paying Daniels $130,000. Where does this place him in terms of legal vulnerability?
Well, this really goes to the heart of complaints that my organization, Common Cause, filed with the Federal Election Commission and the Department of Justice earlier this year, because what it seeks to do is vindicate Americans' right to know who is trying to influence our votes and our views, especially when we're talking about this $130,000 payment, you know, at the height of the presidential election when the Trump campaign was reeling from allegations about his sexual assault of women after the Access Hollywood tape. And we think this money was hush money to keep damaging information out of the election. That goes to the heart of why this, we think, is a campaign finance violation and why we're asking for an investigation. Just real quick, you know, federal campaign finance law, it regulates both the source and the amount of money to influence our elections. You can't give more than $2,700 per election, and it cannot be from corporate coffers like the Trump Organization. So if Mr. Cohen, in cooperation or coordination with the Trump campaign, or was if he was acting on behalf of the Mr. Trump or the Trump Organization, and we think there's strong reason to believe that was what was going on, then he would have violated both the amount, certainly the amount in violation, potentially the source in violation, and of course this money was secret. It was hush money. It was never disclosed, which is the third prong of our federal campaign finance laws, vindicating people's right to know who's spending money to influence our elections.
So, David Folkenflik, help me out here, because I think a lot of people might be confused about this. Cohen has acknowledged paying Daniels $130,000, but has he said specifically why he paid the money?
You know, my recollection was that he saw this as a nuisance that they wanted to deal with. It's a little baffling. If you're both denying the allegation and you're paying the money, why are you paying the money?
Well, exactly.
Paying the money to have her not repeat things that you're saying are untrue. It's it would seem to me as though and I'm not the lawyer here, but it would seem to me as though she would be in more legal jeopardy if she were repeating allegations that were true rather than repeating allegations in some ways that were not true, given the agreement that they signed in, I guess it was October of 2016, for her never to speak again. That includes the provision that she has to pay $1 million every time she does so. That they say that they're trying to enforce, even though they're saying concurrently that it's untrue. And in fact, this morning, I believe on Good Morning America, a lawyer for Michael Cohen, so let's be clear, that's a lawyer for the president, went on the air to say he intends to collect up to $20 million given all the statements she's made so far. That is, he's threatening publicly to enforce this, which, again, it just seems to me that more damages attaches if what she's saying is violating an agreement to say things publicly that are true. So there may be others out there that can clarify that for us.
Yeah, but you've explained it well. I mean, why hush money to not talk about allegations that you're claiming are not true? I mean, it's a befuddling question. Meredith Blake, I want to come to you. We heard Stephen Spaulding talking about this sort of legal vulnerability, perhaps, that Mr. Cohen is in. How does that sort of connect to Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation? In other words, this could essentially put Michael Cohen in front of Robert Mueller, who is already, we understand, interested in Mr. Cohen.
Well, I am by no means a legal expert, but the 60 Minutes report. One of the interesting things about it I found was how quickly they pivoted from Stormy's, account of their alleged affair to the potential political ramifications of it. And they focused on the fact that Cohen, if he has in fact violated campaign finance laws, could potentially be vulnerable to Mueller, who we've seen has targeted people in Trump's inner circle for other kinds of alleged crimes, most obviously Paul Manafort, who is facing charges of tax fraud. And the belief is his strategy is trying to get people close to Trump to flip, to inform what they know about Russia and potential collusion. So that, to me, seemed to be what they were drilling down on in the report last night, was the potential implications of Cohen's legal vulnerability. I think journalistically that was probably the right decision to focus on that as opposed to the salacious details.
Yep. Let's go to Samantha, who's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Samantha, go ahead.
Hi, Anthony. Thank you for the opportunity to participate. Why is it so difficult to follow and believe the trail of behaviors and subsequent reactions reported? It appears to me that somehow inherently Ms. Daniels is the one deemed as unbelievable and given the burden of proof by society. What is keeping us seemingly as a society en masse from simply sitting with Ms. Daniels' version, even for one moment, and asking ourselves two questions? What does this report, if taken as truth, mean to us? And secondly, what is our next step in addressing this responsibly and fully? Human rights and dignity are at stake in this.
Samantha, thanks for putting that on the table. Meredith, I think your piece addressed that question quite specifically. You want to talk to Samantha about it?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I mean, Stormy herself specifically said this wasn't a Me Too moment, but I think we as a society still have issues believing women. You know, we have issues believing victims in general and specifically women. And, you know, there are some credibility issues with Daniels given what she signed, but I think I think she's a woman who's up against an enormous power infrastructure. She's up against literally the most powerful man in the world. And she's also someone who's going to be judged for her line of work, who has been judged for her line of work. And I think, you know, I think that's one of the big questions here is why do we inherently not believe her? Or not we, but many people.
Right.
I think it's an important part of the story.
Oh, I appreciate the question. Let's go to Frederick, who's calling from Watertown, Mass. Frederick, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi.
Go ahead. You're
hi,
on.
Hi, Anthony.
Hi there.
Hi, Anthony. So my question is, and I guess it's more of a comment, is, you know, Stormy Daniels is really, to me, not the the focus, where the focus should be. It should be on the fact that we have a president who has demonstrated time and again a pattern, a behavior, and a process to try to cover up that as we look forward, what else is going on? I mean, what the innuendo about Russia, is that legitimate? I mean, you really have to say we have a person in the White House who is spending all his time trying to obfuscate, and we are all going to be culpable at the end of it, and we have a Congress that plays games of see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil.
Frederick, thanks for the call. David Falkenflik, do you want to respond to Frederick, what you just heard there?
Well, you know, we're all on news overload and we're on scandal overload and we're on a lot of things overload, and we have been for a while now. And this scandal shouldn't be a scandal, to my mind, journalistically, on the basis of whether or not sexual relations occurred between the president and this pornographic star, as crazy as that is to say out loud, because if you think of under any presidency of either party, this would have been a huge scandal. Mm-hmm. It certainly predated not only his presidency, but his active running for office by quite a lot. But this really has legal implications. And actually, the president has gone to court through his lawyers to try to compel Stormy Daniels' silence. So, you know, he has enjoined this battle legally. This is not simply being played out for the benefit of tabloid producers. I do think that there are other issues that are very important to be teased out and that are ongoing concurrently. And the question is, can we have a split-screen society where we're all looking at these multiple things at the same time? It seems to me that it's worth not allowing the fact that there are a lot of other important, very important issues occurring, whether from foreign policy to the Mueller investigation to the question of Cambridge Analytica to the like, to avoid the fact that this is actually now a legal case that could embroil the president rather seriously. And there are implications here, not just for his behavior, but for some of the questions that are being ventilated in courtroom proceedings and filings. So I totally understand our caller's frustration on this, and I think that you're seeing news organizations devote a lot of copy and attention to other things. I do think, to be honest, that for a long time this question had been simmering beneath the surface, and it turns out that even if Stormy Daniels disavows it, it is something part of the Me Too moment where you're seeing, you know, a reality show contestant involved in Mr. Trump's programs. You're seeing a former Playboy centerfold who said she had a personal relationship with Trump that lasted quite some time, where that she was quite taken with him. And now a pornographic star said she had a sexual liaison with him. And there are different ways in which his behavior is implicated beyond the bedroom that is getting much closer scrutiny.
Well, Stephen Spaulding. Yeah, go ahead. Jump right in. I have a specific question for you, but go ahead. Jump in.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, I do think what we're discussing here, this is one chapter in a long volume of examples of this president and his contempt, frankly, for the norms and the rules of democracy. The allegations that we alleged here go to our campaign finance laws that are intended to protect the integrity of our electoral process and of our democracy. But again, to this point about the attention, this is the salacious details aside, this is a case about about these laws and the integrity of our democracy. We have filed other complaints about this president and campaign finance violations. For example, the outside group America First Policies, which we believe is an outside group that was established by President Trump. We think he helped found it. And we think all of the money that they're raising, seven-figure checks from corporations and otherwise, violate our campaign finance laws, violate soft money prohibitions that we tried to close years ago with McCain-Feingold. We're filing a complaint this morning against Cambridge Analytica and its executives. We are not supposed to have our laws prohibit foreign nationals from making decisions in our elections. So there's a whole, and of course the Mueller investigation, right, which a significant part of that is following the money and upholding these laws and upholding our values of everyone having an equal voice and an equal say in our democracy.
Stephen Spaulding, I want to come back to you for just sticking with the legal ramifications of this. Politico published an interesting piece this morning from Josh Gerstein and Lorraine Wallert. And the idea was that the Trump's lawyer payment, the payment by Mr. Cohen to the porn star, draws comparisons to the John Edwards case. Edwards, of course, saw his reputation savaged when his affair with Rielle Hunter was revealed during the 2008 presidential campaign. But what parallels might there be to these two cases, in your view?
There are very strong parallels. What we're talking about in both cases are about in-kind campaign contributions that were made in coordination or consultation with a campaign. In the Edwards case, this money was going to Rielle Hunter to provide for, apparently to provide for child care and other expenses, but really, again, to keep that information out of the news cycle at the time. Here, I think we have a much stronger case. Here we have Michael Cohen. The reporting has shown that he was emailing from his Trump Organization account. We know that he says he would do anything to protect the president, including apparently violating these laws. Now, in the Edwards case, the Department of Justice brought that case all the way to trial, and in most counts, it ended in a hung jury. But I think we have a much stronger case here. And the legal standard when it comes to the Federal Election Commission is, is there reason to believe that a violation may have occurred? And if the answer is yes, then they are supposed to move forward on an investigation. We are under no illusions that the FEC is one of the most dysfunctional agencies in Washington, D.C. But I think this is one of the strongest cases that is before it that we know about through involving Mr. Trump and the Trump Organization. The Department of Justice, it's a knowing and willful standard. But we have every indication, as the reporting has shown, that they're aware of this as well.
All right, I want to try to get one more call in before the break. Let's go to Debbie, who's calling from Sudbury, Mass. Debbie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Anthony. Thanks for taking my call. Listen, I very much believe, after hearing Stormy Daniels last night, this very much is a Me Too situation for her. From what she described, Trump dangled a possible position of being on The Apprentice and maybe some other career enhancements for her in order to get sex from her. And she acquiesced and gave in, even though she wasn't attracted to him. And then her later contacts with him, on her part, from what she described, were all about trying to see what he was actually going to do for her career. And, you know, she gave in. This is just like Harvey Weinstein, except she gave in. And, you know, I wonder, this poor woman, I've never felt sympathy for a porn star before, but, you know, as Oprah recently has been saying, what happened to you? You know, what happened to this woman that led her down this path, that she had to provide sex to this man in order to try and enhance her career? And this is absolutely a Me Too movement.
Got it, even though she denies it. But Debbie, thanks so much for putting that thought on the table. David, we have about 30 or 40 seconds left. Final question to you. What's next? Or what are you sort of sitting there in Washington thinking about, in New York, thinking about what you want to know next about this story? Where does it go?
You know, this story reveals a lot, and at least in its allegations and sort of the associated stories around it. It reveals a little bit, you know, in terms of the questions of the ways in which possible election laws need to be looked at in terms of the Trump campaign's behavior. It looks at the relationship of the press and Trump, if you think about some of the tabloids, their favoritism here. And it would not surprise me if more issues and allegations were to crop up. I think we need to watch closely on how he deals with those allegations and how he deals with this one through his surrogates.
Well, lots more to come on this story, no doubt. David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NBR, thanks so much for joining us today.
You bet.
And Meredith Blake, staff writer at the Los Angeles Times, thank you. It was great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And Stephen Spaulding, chief of strategy and external affairs at Common Cause. Stephen, thank you. It was a great pleasure having you as well.
Thank you, Anthony. I appreciate it.
Listeners, stay with us. After the break, we're going to talk about the March for Our Lives and students leading the national charge against gun violence. We'll be right back after a short break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
When C.C. Wong met his mom's new tenant, he never suspected he'd end up getting replaced as a son, or that his replacement might have sinister motives. This week, Invisibilia looks at the things we don't say to our loved ones and the misunderstandings it can lead to. Listen on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. 5 weeks after the deadly shooting in Parkland, Florida, the students of Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School led a historic march for gun control Saturday. Students, parents, and survivors joined the March for Our Lives in Washington, D.C., and across the U.S., over 800 cities joined the marches. Their message for lawmakers, never again on gun violence. You can join us on the air or online. Were you at the march this weekend? What do you make of this national outcry? Is this the moment when America finally starts to take action on gun violence? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's listen to a little bit of tape from this past weekend. Emma Gonzalez, one of the survivors of the February 14th shootings in Parkland, Florida, spoke at the March for Our Lives in Washington on Saturday. And her remarks included a powerful moment of silence that was just as long as the attack on Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School.
Since the time that I came out here, it has been 6 minutes and 20 seconds. The shooter has ceased shooting and will soon abandon his rifle, blend in with the students as they escape and walk free for an hour before arrest. Fight for your lives before it's someone else's job.
Emma Gonzalez speaking in Washington, D.C. this past weekend. And joining me now from New York is Lois Beckett. She's senior reporter for The Guardian, covering gun policy, criminal justice, and the far right. Lois, welcome back to On Point. It's good to have you.
Hi, Anthony.
Also joining me now from Washington is David Hogg. He's a high school senior and survivor of that February 14th mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. He spoke at the march in D.C. on Saturday as well. And David, welcome back to you. It's good to have you back on Point.
Thank you. I love listening to NPR, so it's an honor to be here.
Lois, I want to just start with you and get your overall response to what happened on Saturday. How unprecedented, how big, any way you want to describe it. What struck you about that day?
So I've been covering gun control and gun violence prevention for more than 5 years now. And so it was just stunning to me to see some of the same young activists and some of the same people who have been speaking out about everyday violence in their communities in Chicago or Brooklyn to crowds of hundreds of people or maybe 1,000 suddenly speaking to a national audience of hundreds of thousands of people. This is not a new issue for the people who are most affected by it, and people have been turning out and organizing for years. But what you saw is suddenly the nation really paying attention and a new degree of anger and a new degree of intensity. For decades, political scientists have talked about the intensity gap between the NRA and gun control supporters. Americans will say that they want stricter gun laws, but they haven't really turned up to fight for it. And on Saturday, they really turned up in by the hundreds of thousands, giving a real sense that maybe this is the turning point.
You know, talk a little more about that, Lois, because, of course, sadly, over many, many years and watching one dreadful event, one horrible, tragic school shooting, mass shooting after another, there's momentary outrage by many, and then that moment passes and business goes on as usual. That doesn't seem to be happening this time, and I'm wondering what explains that in your view.
Well, I think there's one really important thing that happened on Saturday that people have talked about, but that needs even more attention. And that is, like the sentence you just said, you know, look at these school shootings. We talk about Columbine. We talk about Virginia Tech. We talk about Sandy Hook. There's this history of what gun violence looks like in America, and it's a history of attacks on rural or suburban schools, where we know that the majority of people who die in America, the majority of children killed in America each year, that's happening every day, and it's not happening at random. It's happening in very concentrated areas in neighborhoods defined by decades of racial segregation, by economic underinvestment. And so for, you know, the problem that we've seen with the gun control movement in America is that white Americans really haven't shown up. Suburban Americans really haven't shown up consistently because this is not an issue that they saw as affecting them very often. That despite the incredible toll of gun violence on America as a whole, because it was mostly concentrated in black and brown neighborhoods, the rest of America wasn't willing to show up to fight to change it. And what was so striking about Saturday was that the student organizers made a choice not to have a token single activist from Chicago, but to have multiple young activists of color from Brooklyn, from South Los Angeles, from Washington, D.C., speak through the whole entire event. And that's one of the big questions going forward is, will Americans in the suburbs, will white Americans keep showing up, keep fighting for this issue? And you know, I think that's the question we have to ask going forward.
It's a huge question. I want to hear a voice from Saturday, Naomi Wadler, an 11-year-old elementary school from Alexandria, Virginia, delivered a really passionate speech representing African-American women who are victims of gun violence. Here she is.
I am here today to acknowledge and represent the African-American girls whose stories don't make the front page of every national newspaper. Stories don't lead on the evening news. I represent the African-American women who are victims of gun violence, who are simply statistics instead of vibrant, beautiful girls at full of potential.
Naomi Wadler, 11 years old, an elementary student from Alexandria, Virginia, speaking on Saturday. David Hogg, a high school senior, you survived that awful event of February 14th, the mass shooting at Marjory Stoneham Douglas High School. Tell me what you took away from Saturday.
What I think we saw on Saturday was really the start of an amazing revolution. What we saw was the materialization of all the online support that we've been getting, and really just everybody coming together, not as Democrats, not as Republicans, not as black and white, but as Americans. And that's what I really think this country needs. We need to put down our partisan divide, and we need to come together as Americans and work to ensure the safety and security of every single American man, woman, and child. Because if we don't, how can we continue to say we're the greatest country on earth if we don't face a lot of the problems that we have here?
Mm. Listeners, were you at the march this weekend? What do you make of the national response to gun violence that expressed itself so eloquently on Saturday? Let's go to Jeff, who's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Jeff, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Anthony. I'm just so impressed with this younger generation. I went to the State House in Iowa, and it was a crowd full of diversity during a snowstorm, and there were all different ages, all different walks of life and colors and people from the suburbs and people from the city of Des Moines and people from out of town, and it was just incredible. I think Trump White House is totally outclassed by these kids. Plus, the Trump White House is outclassed by the Washington big leagues. The New York Trumps are just they're losers.
Jeff, thanks so much for the phone call. David Hogg, I want to come back to you. You suggested that you were encouraged at the response on Saturday, and no doubt there was a lot of passion, a lot of people participating. But last week we saw Congress pass a big funding bill that was signed into law by President Trump. There was no mention of new gun measures. Did that discourage you in any way?
No, it only proves what I have already known and what I think a lot of Americans have known well before me, and that's that many of these politicians, they do care about these kids' lives, but what they care a whole lot more about is funding from the NRA and getting reelected. And I think that it's great to see some politicians taking action, but what's important to realize is with many of these measures, for example, in Florida, where we saw the age raised to buy a firearm publicly raised to 21, you can still purchase one privately. And there isn't a universal background check. And at the federal level, we saw, for example, with the Dickey Amendment, them clarifying that they can do research, but they didn't include new spending so that they can ensure through, for example, a categorical grant that there is spending specifically going towards something that kills almost as many people as leukemia every year in the United States, and that's gun violence. And right now, they're not able to fund that, and that's unbelievable and unacceptable to me, and I think to a lot of Americans. And to the caller that just called in, I'd say thank you so much for coming out there and showing your support. It's only through the hard work of individuals like you going to your state capitals, going to the national capital, and going to your local legislators and making your voice heard as their constituents constantly and making sure that they don't forget and that they are constantly reminded that they're working for you. They aren't working for any lobbyists. Now, one important thing to realize is I've been getting a lot of questions about what's next, because a lot of people have been concerned about that. And I want everybody to know out there that on April 7th, we're calling for a town hall in every congressional district. You can go to townhallproject.org and set up your own town hall event through that. And if your local legislator refuses to come because for whatever reason, if they refuse to come to it, simply invite their opponent. It's as simple as that. Then after that, on April 20th, we have another national school walkout. And after that, we're calling for a march on every state capitol to lobby for more gun sense laws in this country. We're ironing out the details of that, but we soon will have a public stance and an official date for all of that. And
so, David, it sounds like the point here is that things didn't end on Saturday. They're just getting started. Hold that thought. I'm going to come back to you on sort of what's next, but I want to get some more callers into this conversation. Let's go to Carlos, who's calling from Mustang, Oklahoma. Carlos, it's good to have you. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. And my question would be for little Davy Hogg. What are you going to do whenever the 5 million members of the NRA take up arms against your faction? Because what you're trying to do is confiscation of firearms. And don't tell me that that's not the case. You want to ban assault weapons first, and then you go for other guns, long guns, and then you go for pistols. It's a total travesty to sit there and say that you guys aren't grown for total confiscation of firearms. You want to see us like Australia or England, where we've got have no rights whatsoever.
Carlos, you put a question on the table to David Hogg. So let's let David Hogg respond to your question. David, Carlos is concerned that your ultimate aim is to go after all the firearms of legal gun owners. Is that the case?
No, it's not. And I want to thank Carlos for making his voice heard. I think it's important that at this discussion that we hear all sides of this discussion that we're having as Americans, because our strength is in our diversity of thought, regardless of what your opinion is. But I want everybody to know out there that's listening to know that we are not trying to take your weapons away, because what we understand and respect and support the importance of the Second Amendment. My father owns a weapon. Cameron Caskey's father owns a weapon. We understand the importance of the Second Amendment, and I can see how it can be fearful because change is scary. But what we want to see, in the same way that you want to ensure that you have your Second Amendment rights, and you will, we just want to have implementations where people that have a history of mental illness, people with a history of criminal activity are not able to get these weapons. And we're working to ensure that with these universal background checks that we're trying to implement, that the safety and security of American citizens is protected through, for example, needing a warrant to search a lot of these databases. And we aren't trying to ban all weapons. We're just trying to ban these massive weapons that, in my opinion, I don't think any American needs to protect themselves. You can do it with a handgun. And I understand that it can be fearful for a lot of people to see this change because it is your Second Amendment right. But I think in the same way that we have limitations on the first, where people can essentially say whatever they want, they can't yell fire in a crowded theater, and I don't think you should be able to get a weapon if you're a person with a criminal history or mental illness.
Got it, David Hogg. Lois Beckett, I want you to respond a little bit to what Carlos talked about, because he talked about the feelings of 5 million NRA members. Can you put that in perspective for us? I mean, what do we know about the full membership of the NRA or legal gun-owning Americans about how they feel about strengthening gun control?
So this is
is an issue that's obviously very tense, and public opinion surveys do show that a majority of Americans, even a majority, large majorities of gun owners, potentially even large majorities of NRA members, support things like background checks for every gun sale. It's important to remember that NRA members, they claim 5 million members, represent perhaps a little less than 10% of all American gun owners by the best estimates that we have. So the NRA is a pretty small group even within American gun owners. But what's so striking about this whole debate is certainly that the Parkland students and the movement that we saw on Saturday is pushing for ban on assault weapons and on higher capacity magazines. But as David just said, and this is a consistent message, they've said, you know, we're not interested in restricting handguns. Americans have a right to own handguns. We're not interested in addressing that, which makes this American movement strikingly different from gun control movements in the UK, for example, where handgun ownership, civilian handgun ownership is very, very low and handguns are very tightly regulated. So while this movement feels dramatic in American context, from a global context, it's actually, you know, pretty pro-gun in a lot of ways.
Interesting. David, talking about what comes next, April 7th town hall in every congressional district, you said there's going to be another set of marches April 20th. Tell me, in terms of legislation that you're specifically looking for, what are you pressuring, for example, your members of Congress to do right now?
Yeah, so I'm really glad that you asked that. We have five main points. The first one is a universal background check that we're trying to implement for Americans that have a criminal background in history so that they're not able to get these weapons. Because right now, the fact that you can purchase a firearm without a background check, for example, at gun shows, were from the estimates that I've seen, is around 40% of all gun purchases are at gun shows, and many of them are private and don't require a background check. So universal background checks, we want to get funding and a categorical grant for the CDC to fund research into gun violence where the funding cannot be shifted away from it, and they can study something that costs so many lives across America every day.
David, sorry to jump in. I'm going to give you sort of 10 seconds to wrap it up because we are facing the tyranny of the clock. So go ahead. Wrap that up.
So essentially what the other ones are is a ban on high-capacity magazines, an assault weapons ban, and the digitalization of ATF records.
Okay. So some big goals there. Lois Beckett, in the sort of 15 seconds that remains, do you believe that Congress might actually act on some of those in the months ahead?
What really matters is what happens in the 2018 midterms. If pro-gun lawmakers are voted out because of the actions of these students, then this march will have made a big difference. If the 2018 activism doesn't deliver, then this March for Our Lives will be like the Million Mom March in 1999, which brought hundreds of thousands of people to Washington but didn't change laws. This was an important moment, but the only thing that matters is what happens with the votes in 2018.
All right. Well, stay tuned for that. Lois Beckett, senior reporter for The Guardian. David Hogg, high school senior and survivor of the shooting at Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Thank you both very much.
Thank you for witnessing this revolution.
That's it for this hour. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.